Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So today, we're pushing a bit further into the core of the RAFT program. Mm-hmm. That's RAFT, which we pronounce just as RAFT. And as a quick reminder, it stands for Recognize, Abandon, Freedom, and Train.
And if you think about the last two creative powers we discussed, noble desire and courageous energy, they're sort of the engine and the fuel for your RAFT.
Right.
Well, today, we're installing the steering system.
Right.
And maybe the gyroscope to keep it all steady. We're diving into Chapter 23, The Heart's Compass as a Creative Power.
Okay, let's unpack this right away. Because Heart's Compass, or Siddha, it sounds, I don't know, a little deceptive in its simplicity.
It does.
But the material positions it as absolutely essential. It's the stabilizer. It has to work with that energy, with that desire to make sure that when, you know, the storms hit, we actually have direction and we stay upright.
It's the ultimate integrator, really. The Heart's Compass is a state of mind, but the authors really emphasize the emotive, conscious, even the intuitive side of things over just cold logic.
So the heart mind.
The heart mind, exactly.
Yeah.
And it speaks to that universal idea, you hear it all the time, that the longest journey you will ever take is the 18 inches from your head to your heart.
Mm. But the RAFT program seems to be arguing it's not just about feeling more, it's about an active alignment.
Yes, exactly. It's an active cognitive alignment, your head and your heart working together.
That distinction feels crucial. Because we usually think of the head as the driver and the heart is, well, just along for the ride.
Right.
But the quotes they open with challenge that completely. I'm thinking of the Van Morrison lyric, "If my heart could do my thinking and my head began to feel," it suggests a total reversal.
A complete reversal.
Yeah.
And Carl Jung reinforces that same idea, saying, "Your vision will become clear only when you look into your heart." The point is that pure analysis, you know, just thinking your way through a problem, often fails to give you the clarity you really need. You need the whole picture.
So let's dig into Siddha itself. This one word in this framework, it seems to cover everything. Thoughts, emotions, consciousness, what they call deep intuitive knowing.
It's huge.
Yeah.
And because it's so powerful, it can be your greatest ally or, if it's all over the place,
your biggest obstacle.
Your biggest obstacle. Think of that old analogy of the mind as an untamed horse. When it's scattered, it's not just distracted, it's running wild. It's just pulled around by these cravings and aversions.
These harmful compulsions we've talked about. And the hard part is, those compulsions feel like us.
They do. Which brings us to what the material calls this fiercely liberating insight. And that is, I am not my mind.
We experience our thoughts, they're real events, but they aren't necessarily true.
Exactly. And that's where the freedom starts. If we believe every single demanding or fearful thought that pops into our head, we're just trapped.
Hmm.
The material quotes Byron Katie here, and it's perfect. A thought is harmless unless we believe it. It's not our thoughts, but the attachment to our thoughts that causes suffering.
That is such a powerful idea. But for someone trying this, I mean, separating thoughts from attachment to thoughts can feel almost impossible. How does the program help you bridge that gap?
Well, the shift comes from seeing the heart's compass as having two jobs. It's both a compass and a stabilizer.
Okay.
So let's take a real-world example. You get some really difficult news. A big setback at work, maybe. The untamed mind, what does it do? It immediately goes to fear, self-blame, panic.
Right. The raft is being tossed around. It's about to capsize.
Precisely. The stabilizer function is what stops that immediate capsize. It's that moment where you can just pause, you can breathe, and you don't immediately fire off that angry email or fall into a spiral.
Okay. So it stops the bleeding. And the compass function.
This compass gently reminds you of your bigger goal, of your aspiration for freedom. It guides you toward a skillful response, not just a reactive one. It points you away from that immediate shore of suffering.
That really helps make the metaphor active. So if we break this heart's compass down, the program gives us five facets. It really shows how comprehensive the Siddha is. It starts with the cognitive bit, mind and consciousness.
The basic thinking function. But right away, number two is heart and emotion.
Yeah.
The effective part. Your heart's compass is literally colored by your emotional state.
So if you're feeling joy or compassion, the compass is bright and clear.
Exactly. But if you're drowning in aversion or confusion, it's obscured. It's a dynamic system. It's always changing.
And the third one, thought and intention. This is where it gets really consequential because it's the source of our future actions.
Mm-hmm. Gautama, the Buddha, said it perfectly. Whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind.
Our thoughts literally carve the paths of our future.
They do, which leads to the fourth facet, integration. This is why that term heart-mind is so good. It's about blending thoughts and feelings into a a coherent whole.
Right.
But this raises a good question. If our mind, our citta, is supposed to be inherently knowing and luminous, why do we need to train it so much?
And that's the final facet, isn't it? Trainability. This is the game changer. The fact that the mind is malleable, it confirms that it can be purified, it can be liberated.
Yeah.
You are not a fixed thing.
And that is the creative power. It leads to this profound link between our inner world and our outer world. Christina Feldman said, "The shape of your mind shapes your world."
And Vince Cullen expanded on that. "The shape of your heart shapes your world." So training the compass isn't just internal house cleaning. It changes how you experience literally everything.
Yeah. The goal isn't to fight your mind. It's to befriend it, to move away from those harmful, compulsive cycles.
So how? How do we do it? The RAFT program doesn't just define this. It lays out six very systematic practices for building this stability.
These are the daily exercises, the reins on that untamed horse.
Okay, let's spend some real time on these because this is the how-to that people need. Number one is clarifying aspiration, resolve.
Yes. This is about setting a magnetic north for your compass every single day, consciously reflecting on your goal of freedom from suffering.
It's inspired by Gautama's resolve under the Bodhi tree.
It is. And a really practical way to do this isn't just to think about it. It's to, you know, actually write down your intention in one sentence each morning. Or find a physical object, like a small rock in your pocket. Yeah. That's a tangible reminder all day.
I like that. So after resolve, you need focus to maintain it. That's number two. Strengthening mental unification. A gathered mind.
A gathered mind. Without focus, even the best aspiration just fades away. This is your calm, abiding practice.
So mindfulness of breathing.
For practice, yeah, they suggest 10 to 30 minutes of mindfulness of breathing. But here's the key. When your mind wanders, and it absolutely will.
Oh, it will.
The practice isn't to get mad at it. It's to just gently, patiently bring it back to the breath. And each time you do that, you're doing a rep, you're training the muscle. That's the whole practice.
So the wandering isn't a failure, it's actually the opportunity.
Okay.
Then comes number three, generating inner zeal, noble desire.
Yeah, this journey takes stamina. And if you see your practice as just another heavy chore on your to-do list, you're going to burn out.
You have to find the joy in it.
You have to. You have to fuel it with wholesome passion.
Mm.
The practice here is to actively seek out inspiration. Read teachings, listen to people who inspire you, reflect on the benefits you've already seen. You have to reinforce that joy.
That zeal then needs muscle. That's number four. Using determination as a fuel for courageous energy.
Appropriate effort. It's essential. This means sustained conscious energy, but applied skillfully, not just brute force.
Right.
The danger is setting some huge unrealistic goal and then failing. The better way is to set a small, achievable daily commitment, maybe just 20 minutes of meditation, and then you refuse to compromise on that small thing, that refusal, that daily act of determination. That's the fuel.
Okay. Number five, strengthening the compass through fearless investigation. This feels like the calibration phase.
It is. It's about being really honest with yourself.
Yeah.
Actively assessing your progress and your obstacles. Gautama taught that this kind of regular reflection sharpens the heart's compass. A great way to do this is to keep a journal. And ask yourself, is my desire for freedom getting stronger or weaker? And if it's weaker, why?
That's real inner accountability. And finally, number six, letting go of doubt and strengthening confidence.
Doubt is such a heavy anchor on the raft, isn't it? It just slows everything down.
Oh, it does.
Now, some doubt is natural, but when it becomes this obsessive skepticism that just paralyzes you, you have to counter it. The practice is twofold. First, daily recollection of the real, tangible progress you've already made.
Okay.
And second, intentionally surrounding yourself with wise friends, with a supportive environment that reinforces your aspiration. Confidence in the path makes the compass steady.
When you lay all six out like that, it's clear the heart's compass is this deep, wholehearted commitment. It's the force that lets you persevere through the storms.
Absolutely. And the ultimate example of this is Gautama himself.
Yeah.
Right before his awakening. I mean, that level of resolve is just... it's almost shocking.
What did he say?
He cultivated a determination so total that he declared, "Let only skin, sinews, and bones remain, but I will not give up my exertion until I have attained what can be attained by human strength, energy, and effort."
Wow. I mean, that's That is absolute commitment. It shows that this kind of freedom, it demands that kind of rightly directed focus.
An unshakable force.
Yeah. Now, for listeners who, you know, appreciate connecting these ancient ideas to modern science, the alignment here is actually really satisfying.
Oh, it's deeply satisfying. Training the heart's compass isn't some mystical thing. It is neurologically sound.
Let's start with neuroscience. We know mindfulness training stabilizes our attention networks. Specifically, it reduces activity in something called the default mode network, the DMN.
Right. The DMN is basically the brain's restless background noise generator. It's linked to mind wandering, craving loops, rumination, all those harmful compulsive behaviors that keep us stuck.
That internal chatter that never stops.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And this training, it's like literally boosting your brain's impulse control center. Consistent practice increases activity in the prefrontal cortex, the PFC.
The command center.
The command center for planning, emotional regulation, all of it. So by strengthening the PFC, we are stabilizing our RAFS gyroscope. We're building the neurological foundation for clarity and patience.
And in psychology, this aligns perfectly with things like MBCT, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and DBT.
Absolutely. Both of those therapies are teaching people to observe their thoughts without judgment. They're building that space we talked about, that I am not my mind. That enhances psychological flexibility, so we can respond wisely instead of just getting swept away.
And philosophically, you can see strong links to things like virtue ethics or even stoicism.
It's all about living an intentional life. All of these traditions teach us to develop a reflective, disciplined mind that can respond wisely to challenges. That's what a well-directed heart's compass gives you.
It all comes together in that quote from the Dhammapada. It really drives home the power of this internal work. Neither mother, nor father, nor any other relative can do as much good as a well-directed mind.
It's our deepest, most powerful creative resource.
So, to wrap up this deep dive on Siddha, the heart's compass is both the guide and the stabilizer.
Mm-hmm. It's the creative power that allows for clear, wise choices and maintains your resilience. And by cultivating it with those six practices, you prepare for the final stage of the journey, fearless investigation.
And before we close, we absolutely want to mention that the material we've covered today is from the RAFT to Freedom workbook, which was written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And they are making all 66 chapters of this program freely available online for anyone who wants to use these practices.
You can find everything we've discussed, all the prompts and practices, at raft2freedom.org. That's raft, the number two, freedom.org.
And as you go about your day, maybe take a moment for this specific self-reflection prompt from the program, just to make this personal. Ask yourself,
could my journey towards freedom be more caring, joyful, and creative?
Mm. And contemplate where your attention gets pulled off course.
Yeah.
What are those dominant thought patterns that pull you back to suffering? Just identifying the horse is the first step to taming it.
That's the power of internal guidance, isn't it? Remembering that answers aren't always out there somewhere. They're in the stillness and clarity of the heart-mind.
Indeed.
And with that, we'll leave you with the final profound thought from this chapter. If you want to know the path, ask your heart.